From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Apartheid exists in its most despicable forms. The Palestinians are deprived of basic human rights. Their land has been occupied and then confiscated and then colonized by the Israeli settlers.
President Jimmy Carter, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, has a new book out, and it's generating plenty of controversy. It's called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. We'll hear the former U.S. president in his own words. Then a Muslim attorney in Oregon has been awarded $2 million and a written apology from the U.S. government. 2 years ago, he was jailed after the FBI mistakenly linked him to the Madrid train bombings. In a national broadcast exclusive, Brandon Mayfield will join us from Portland to talk about his case. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The bipartisan Iraq Study Group has agreed to call for a gradual pullback of U.S. troops from Iraq and to open negotiations with Iran and Syria. The report is expected next week. According to the New York Times, the panel implicitly says the withdrawal should begin next year, but the report does not set a firm timetable and leaves open-ended the question of whether U.S. troops should be deployed to neighboring countries or brought home. Since its inception, the Iraq Study Group's critics have accused it of being a tool to provide political cover for the status quo. A senior U.S. military officer involved in Iraq planning said, quote, "The question is whether it doesn't look like a timeline to Bush and does to Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri Maliki." Meanwhile, President Bush met with Maliki in Jordan today. The meeting was supposed to happen Wednesday, but Maliki canceled at the last minute. The cancellation came hours after the New York Times published contents of a Bush administration memo that expressed serious doubts on Maliki's performance. In appearance with Maliki today, the U.S. president said U.S. forces would stay indefinitely and rejected calls to partition Iraq.
Prime Minister made clear that splitting his country into parts, as some have suggested, is not what the Iraqi people want, and that any partition of Iraq would only lead to an increase in sectarian violence. I agree.
President Bush was also asked about Iraq's sectarian violence.
Well, that's killers taking innocent life is, in some cases, sectarian. I happen to view it as criminal, as well as sectarian. I think anytime you murder somebody, you're a criminal. And I believe a just society and a society that holds people to account and believes in rule of law protects innocent people from murderers, no matter what their political party is.
Meanwhile, a key Shiite political bloc has carried out on its threat to end participation in the Iraqi government if Maliki sat down with Bush. This is Salah al-Akali, a member of Shia cleric Maqdar al-Sadr's political group.
Therefore, the Sadr bloc in the House of Representatives and the Sadr movement and ministers are suspending their membership in Parliament and the government to protest against this visit, which provokes the Iraqi people's feelings and disregards their constitutional rights.
Bush's summit with Maliki comes amid unrelenting violence in Iraq. At least 102 people were killed Wednesday, including two U.S. troops. In a sharp departure from the Bush administration, former Secretary of State Colin Powell said Wednesday the war in Iraq could be considered a civil war. Powell was speaking at a conference in Dubai. Meanwhile, an advisor to the Saudi Arabian government has declared Saudi Arabia will intervene in Iraq to protect the Sunni community if the United States withdraws. Writing in the Washington Post, the advisor, Nawaf Obaid, said the government of King Abdullah would arm and fund Sunni military leaders and help establish Sunni brigades to fight against Iranian-backed Shia militias. Obaid writes, quote, "Saudi engagement in Iraq carries great risks. It could spark a regional war. So be it. The consequences of inaction are far worse," he wrote. The warning comes 1 week after Vice President Dick Cheney visited Saudi Arabia. The Bush administration initially said Cheney made the trip as part of a diplomatic push in the Middle East, but the Washington Post reports Cheney was basically summoned to visit King Abdullah. In Latvia, NATO leaders ended a summit on Afghanistan without a firm commitment for more troops. The U.S., Britain, and Canada were seeking military assistance, but key members, Spain and Italy, explicitly refused their request. In his appeal for help in Afghanistan, British Prime Minister Tony Blair said NATO's credibility is at stake.
There is, I think, a complete acceptance around the table that NATO's credibility is indeed on the line in respect of this mission, and that if NATO stands for anything, it is the defense of values of liberty and democracy. Those values are being defended now in Afghanistan, and if we don't make sure this mission succeeds, it will have a devastating impact on our own security.
The UN Human Rights Council has announced South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu will lead a fact-finding mission to investigate the killing of 19 Palestinian civilians in the Gaza town of Beit Hanun earlier this month. One family lost 16 members when Israeli tanks opened fire on their house. Seven children died, the youngest just a year old. Israel's blamed the killings on a technical malfunction. Tutu says he's honored with the appointment and hopes the mission will help advance the cause of peace. In Italy, a judge has delayed a hearing to determine whether a U.S. soldier should stand trial for killing an Italian intelligence agent escorting the kidnapped reporter Giuliana Screna in Iraq. The soldier, Mario Lozano, of the U.S. Army's 69th Infantry Regiment in New York, is accused of voluntary homicide. The hearing has been put off until February. Giuliana Screna spoke to reporters about the delay.
The fact of delaying so much a case that caused an enormous outcry at the time it happened and that now seems to have lost it seems to me one more element in order to lower the attention on the Calipari case.
In Geneva, UN Relief Coordinator Jan Egeland held his last press conference Wednesday before he steps down next month.
UN is still not living up to the solemnly sworn responsibility to protect. 2 million of people in the whole sub-region of Darfur, Chad, and Central African Republic are living in utter fear. Too many people in Iraq, Afghanistan, or in the Palestinian territories as well.
Jan Egeland is the UN's top humanitarian official. He went on to address the situation in Darfur, which he says is getting worse by the day.
What the UN has to do now more is through its member states to put pressure on the government, on the rebels, on Sudan, on the neighboring countries, to stop this man-made disaster, to get a credible international force on the ground to protect the civilian population and to get a negotiated settlement between the government and the armed opposition.
In Mexico, former President Luis Echeverria has been ordered to stand trial for his role in the 1968 Tlatelolco massacre of student protesters. Echeverria was the interior minister at the time and has been accused of ordering government forces to open fire. The killings occurred 10 days before Mexico hosted the Olympic Games. Human rights groups estimate up to 300 people were killed. Here in the United States, the Bush administration has been ordered to resume housing payments to thousands of people displaced by Hurricane Katrina. On Wednesday, U.S. District Judge Richard Leon ruled Katrina victims have been illegally denied housing payments and subjected to an application process he called Kafkaesque. Leon ruled FEMA had failed to properly explain why it was cutting off the payments and failed to give evacuees the right to appeal. FEMA's actions left many evacuees homeless. The ruling marked the second court victory for Katrina victims this week. On Monday, a federal court ruled homeowners are entitled to more insurance money for flood damage. In Florida, 8 people have been charged in connection with the death of a 14-year-old boy at a juvenile boot camp last January. The boy, Martin Lee Anderson, was initially said to have died of a complication from sickle cell blood disease, but a second autopsy, demanded by his parents, actually found prison guards suffocated him to death. Video footage shows Anderson collapsing to the ground after one of the guards hit him from behind. 7 guards and 1 nurse have been charged with aggravated manslaughter. This is Florida Governor Jeb Bush.
We'll obviously follow the developments of this case closely and hope at the end of the day that justice will be served. We also hope that when the process is completed that Martin Lee Anderson's family will have the answers to the questions that they legitimately have, and my thoughts and prayers continue to be with them.
Martin Lee Anderson's family has criticized Governor Bush for reacting too slowly to the case and turning down their meeting requests. New figures show the number of Americans in prison or jail is on the rise. A record 2.2 million people are behind bars, up nearly 3% from last year. Another 4 million people are either on probation or parole. The number of female prisoners has seen a significant jump, rising 2.6%. Racial disparities show no signs of reversal. Among males in their late 20s, 8% of African American men are incarcerated, compared with 1% of white men. In other news, the U.S. government has agreed to pay $2 million and apologize to Brandon Mayfield. Mayfield is the Muslim attorney in Oregon, jailed 2 years ago after the FBI mistakenly tied him to the Madrid train bombings. We'll speak with Brandon Mayfield later in the broadcast. The president-elect of the Christian Coalition of America says he won't be taking the job because of the group's opposition to expanding its agenda. The Reverend Joel Hunter says he wanted to address issues including poverty and the environment, but was told the Christian Coalition does not want to move beyond opposing abortion and gay marriage. And finally, a German citizen who suffered torture after being kidnapped by the CIA is in the United States to appeal the dismissal of his lawsuit against the U.S. government. 3 years ago, Khaled al-Masri was seized along the Serbian-Macedonian border and then flown to Afghanistan, where he was tortured inside a secret prison. He was released without charge after 5 months. Masri described his ordeal Tuesday in Washington.
Die ganze 5 Monate hatte ich nur Todesangst gehabt.
I was mortally afraid throughout the entire 5 months in prison in Afghanistan.
Die Haftbedingungen waren wirklich für Sterbliche nicht geeignet.
The conditions I was confronted with in jail were not fit for human consumption.
37 Tage habe ich Hungerstreik durchgemacht.
I went on hunger strike for 37 days.
Ich wurde dann zwangsernährt.
And I was force-fed thereafter.
Irgendwann haben die mich ganz einfach am verlassenen Ort im Wald in der Nacht in Albanien rausgelassen.
And then thereafter I was taken to Albania. And in the middle of the night I was just dumped in a forest.
Ich weiß heute noch, ich weiß nicht, warum hat man mir das angetan hat. Ich weiß nicht, warum man mich überhaupt verhaftet hat, warum bin ich rausgekommen.
To this day, I don't know why they did this to me. I don't know why they arrested me in the first place. I don't know why they released me. I do not know.
Khaled al-Masri speaking on Wednesday in Washington. His suit was dismissed in May after a federal judge sided with the government's argument that trying the case would jeopardize state secrets. Anthony Romero, an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union, criticized the government's position.
It is untenable now for the Bush administration to hide behind its arguments in a court of law and insist that some of the most egregious violations of human rights have no remedy in an American court of law. If not before an American court of law, can an individual who's been wronged by the U.S. government seek justice? Then where?
ACLU head Anthony Romero. Khaled al-Masri's suit names former CIA Director George Tenet and several CIA employees. The lawsuit seeks at least $75,000 in damages. Masri has said he might drop the case if Tenet issues an apology. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Those are the headlines. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world.
Juan, you've been spending this week covering the killing, the police shooting of Sean Bell, who died in a hail of 50 police bullets.
Yes, Sean Bell and two other companions of his who were also shot. One is still in the hospital in critical condition. And of course, it's been caused outrage throughout the city, especially in the African-American community, because once again, there is a police shooting that on its face is inexplicable, but of course they're still investigating the facts. But at this point, it does appear all three were unarmed. They were leaving a bar for a bachelor night out before Sean Bell was supposed to be married that same day, and they had no weapons on them. And but a group of undercover cops approached them, one with a gun in his hand, and began firing because the car lurched forward. Apparently, the men in the car thought that they were being attacked by some patrons from the bar, and there were 50 shots fired, including one officer who fired 31 bullets, discharged his 16 bullets from his gun, reloaded with another clip, and fired another 15 shots at the car.
And the count, we spoke with Kadiatou Diallo, Amadou Diallo's mother, earlier in the week, responding to this because it's so reminiscent of the 41 bullets that Amadou died in a hail of.
Yes, and there have been numerous other cases, but of course the number of bullets here is what is really has outraged so many other people. But there was, for instance, the case a couple of years ago that we also reported about, a young man, Stansberry, who was also killed with one bullet, and where the police commissioner at that time said that it was excessive use of force by a police officer. However, in that particular case, the officer involved, Mary, was never indicted. He went to a departmental trial, was found guilty of not securing his weapon, but the police commissioner, Ray Kelly, has yet to take action on discipline for him. And the departmental trial occurred 6 months ago, and yet the commissioner still has not acted, even though he personally criticized that incident. So you have a situation where when these incidents occur, sometimes the public officials will, especially during the Bloomberg administration, will be at least express some concern about the actions. But it's not what they say at the time of the incident. It's what they do months down the road, what law enforcement does. And many people doubt that there will be even an indictment in the case of these five police officers who were involved in the shooting.
Well, yesterday, Reverend Sharpton and Jesse Jackson went with the family, the wife-to-be. She was about to be married a few hours later to Sean Bell, to the site of the shooting. It's become a kind of shrine there. And we will continue to follow this case.
Right, and the burial will be tomorrow, actually, in Queens. Well, now returning to some of the other stories we've been covering, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter is accusing Israel of creating an apartheid system in the West Bank and Gaza. The charge comes in his new book, Palestine: Peace, Not Apartheid. The Nobel Peace Prize winner has been deeply involved in Middle East policies for the past three decades. As president, he negotiated the Camp David Accords, which secured a lasting peace between Israel and Egypt. In his new book, Jimmy Carter writes, quote, "Israel's continued control and colonization of Palestinian land have been the primary obstacles to a comprehensive peace agreement in the Holy Land." Carter criticizes Israel for building what he describes as an imprisonment wall through the West Bank. He accuses Israel of strangling the residents of Gaza, where the poverty rate has reached 70% and where the malnutrition rate mirrors countries in sub-Saharan Africa. And Carter is critical of Washington's role. He writes, quote, "The United States is squandering international prestige and goodwill and intensifying global anti-American terrorism by unofficially condoning or abetting the Israeli confiscation and colonization of Palestinian territories."
Some of the most vocal critics of Carter's book have been fellow Democrats. Incoming House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said, quote, "It's wrong to suggest that the Jewish people would support a government in Israel or anywhere that institutionalizes ethnically based oppression, and Democrats reject that allegation vigorously," she said. John Conyers, the incoming chair of the House Judiciary Committee, urged Carter to change the title of the book, which he described as offensive and wrong. Meanwhile, the nation's newspapers have largely ignored Jimmy Carter's book since its publication 2 weeks ago. Carter's book hasn't even been mentioned in the news pages of the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, USA Today, Boston Globe, or Los Angeles Times. Well, today on Democracy Now!, we'll hear Jimmy Carter in his own words. On Tuesday night, he discussed his book, Palestine: Peace, Not Apartheid, at an event in Virginia.
Some people have said the title is provocative, and I accept that categorization, but I don't consider the word provocative to be a negative description, because it's designed to provoke discussion and analysis and debate in a country where debate and discussion is almost completely absent.
if it involves any criticism at all of the policies of Israel. And I think the book is very balanced. Secondly, the words of Palestine, peace, not apartheid, were carefully chosen by me. First of all, it's Palestine, the area of Palestinians. It doesn't refer to Israel. I've never and would have implied that Israel is guilty of any form of apartheid in their own country, because the Arabs who live inside Israel have the same voting rights and the same citizenship rights as do the Jews who live there. And the next word is peace. And my hope is that the publication of this book will not only precipitate debate, as I've already mentioned, but also will rejuvenate an absolutely dormant or absent peace process. For the last 6 years, there's not been one single day of good faith negotiations between Israelis and their neighbors, the Palestinians. And this is absolutely a departure from what has happened under all previous presidents since Israel became a nation. We've all negotiated or attempted to negotiate peace agreements. That has been totally absent now for 6 years. So peace. And in the last two words, not apartheid. The alternative to peace is apartheid. Not inside Israel, to repeat myself, but in the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, the Palestinian territory. And there, apartheid exists in its more despicable forms. The Palestinians are deprived of basic human rights. Their land has been occupied and then confiscated and then colonized by the Israeli settlers. And they have now more than 205 settlements in the West Bank itself. And what has happened is, over a period of years, the Israelis have connected settlements with highways. And those highways make the West Bank look like a honeycomb, and maybe a spider web. You can envision it. And in many cases, most cases, the Palestinians are prevented from using the highways at all, and in many cases, even from crossing the highways. I'd like to make one other point. When Israel was founded back in 1948 by the United Nations, Israel was allocated 56% of what we would call the Holy Land between Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea. After the wars, when the Arabs tried to destroy Israel, treaties were worked out, and Israel wound up with 77% of the Holy Land. 22% was designated as the West Bank, and 1% only, Gaza. So at the optimum case, as recognized by all the United Nations resolutions, Israel would wind up with 77% of the area, and the Palestinians only 23%, including Gaza and the West Bank. And remember that Gaza is on the seacoast, where the Philistines lived during the time of King David. And it's separated by 40 kilometers, about 30 miles, from the rest of Palestinian territory. So in order for a Palestinian to go from Gaza to the West Bank, they have to go through 30 miles of Israeli land. So that's just a geographical description. This book is designed to re-stimulate the prospect for peace. And I'm going to just read three options that Israelis face. And I'd like to say at the beginning that none of them are completely acceptable to all Israelis. But for the last 40 years, a strong majority of Israelis have preferred to relinquish Arab land in return for peace. And this sentiment prevailed until the time when Prime Minister Rabin was assassinated by an irate Israeli who didn't like what Rabin and Shimon Peres had done at Oslo in negotiating a peace agreement for which they both received the Nobel Peace Prize.
Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter speaking in Virginia. We'll come back to this address in a minute. Ashraf Aboulay, Debka from Palestine. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Coming up, our national broadcast exclusive with Brandon and Mona Mayfield. But first, we return to the words of former President Jimmy Carter. He was speaking Tuesday night at a book event in Virginia where he read from his new book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid.
Although a clear majority of Israelis are persistently willing to accept terms that are tolerable to most of our Arab neighbors, it is clear that none of the options is attractive for all Israelis. And these are the three options. First one has been discussed quite extensively and most persistently by the present Prime Minister of Israel, Ehud Olmert, who presented this thesis quite early in his career as a young member of the Israeli parliament. He's now the Prime Minister. A forceful annexation of Palestine and its legal absorption into Israel, which could give large numbers of non-Jewish citizens the right to vote and live as equals under the law. So a large sectarian nation involving both Israelis and Palestinians is this option. This would directly violate international standards and the Camp David Accords, which are the basis for peace with Egypt. At the same time, non-Jewish citizens would immediately make up a powerful swing vote if other Israelis were divided. In other words, if Israelis who now have a majority were divided 60-40 or 50-50, as you can see, then if the Palestinians voted as a bloc, they would prevail in establishing the basic policies of Israel if other Israelis were divided. It would ultimately constitute an outright majority in the new greater Israel. This is because of demographic trends. The Palestinians have a much higher birth rate than do the Israelis, the Israeli Jews. In fact, in Gaza, which I describe, the Palestinian birth rate is 4.7% annually, which is the highest in the world. And that means that in Gaza at this time, half their citizens are 15 years old or less. Israel would be further isolated and condemned by the international community. So I think within 20 years or less, in a combined Israel and Palestinian land, the Arabs would actually have a majority, more than the Jews. Second, a system of apartheid. This is, remember, in Palestine, with two peoples occupying the same land, but completely separated from each other, with Israel is totally dominant and suppressing violence by depriving Palestinians of their basic human rights. This is a policy now being followed. Although many citizens of Israel deride the racist connotation, which I certainly don't imply, of prescribing permanent second-class status for the Palestinians. As one prominent Israeli stated, quote, I am afraid that we are moving toward a government like that of South Africa, with a dual society of Jewish rulers and Arab subjects, with few rights of citizenship. The West Bank, this Israeli said, is not worth it. And that's a majority, that's the opinion of a majority of Israelis. An unacceptable modification of this choice now being proposed is a taking of substantial portions of the occupied territory with the remaining Palestinians completely surrounded by walls, fences, and Israeli checkpoints, living as prisoners within the small portion of land left to them. I think you can quickly see the unacceptability of both of those options. There's only one option left, and that is withdrawal to the 1967 border as specified in UN Resolution 242 and as promised legally by the Israeli government in the Camp David Accords and the Oslo Agreement and prescribed in the roadmap of the International Quartet. You remember the Quartet consists of the United States and Russia and the United Nations and the European Union. Those four comprise a quartet. And they have devised the latest proposal known as the Roadmap for Peace, which has been enthusiastically endorsed by President Bush, as you know. This is the most attractive option and the only one that can ultimately be acceptable as a basis for peace. Good faith negotiations can lead to mutually agreeable exchanges of land, perhaps permitting a significant number of Israeli settlers to remain in their present homes near Jerusalem, inside Palestinian territory. One version of this choice was spelled out in the Geneva Initiative. The Geneva Initiative is described in a separate chapter. I was involved in some ways in the preparation of the Geneva Initiative, and I was there and made the keynote speech in Geneva when this initiative was prescribed. But what it does do is work out a compromise between the Palestinians and the Israelis, through which about half of the total Israelis who live now in the West Bank could stay where they are. And the others would withdraw, which would still leave the Palestinians with a contiguous, that is, a constant area of land over which they could have a united government of Palestinians. And also part of that was the swap of land. Whenever the Palestinians would give up part of the land where the large Jewish settlements are built, then the Israelis would give up an equal amount of land that might lie just west of Gaza or in some parts, relatively uninhabited parts of Israel. So it was a swap of land for land. The other step was the right of return. This is a very important thing for Palestinians, none of whom would give this up. It's guaranteed in United Nations Resolution 194, the right of Palestinians to return to their homeland or either to be compensated for their property if they can prove that they actually have title to that property. And the compromise worked out in the Geneva Initiative was, okay, the Palestinians can return, but they can return only to Palestine. They cannot return to Israel, the new nation of Israel, unless the Israelis approve each application for return. But they would still be have available to them some kind of compensation. And the third major issue, I'm summarizing very quickly, is the settlement of the property about who controls or owns East Jerusalem. And this is covered quite extensively throughout the book. But a very good compromise was reached where the holy places would be under the complete control of the Arabs on the one hand and the Jews on the other, including the Wailing Wall and the adjacent land. And then the rest of East Jerusalem would be administered by a joint commission that would take care of housing and schools and garbage collection and water and electricity and that sort of thing. So it was a very good compromise. In my opinion, ultimately, something very close to the Geneva Initiative described in this book is the only avenue toward permanent peace for Israel with justice and peace for the Palestinian neighbors. So the book is deliberately, I wouldn't say controversial, but it's deliberately designed to be provocative because, as I said earlier, in Israel and in Europe, these kind of issues are debated every day in the most vehement way, particularly in Israel. Pros and cons, arguing back and forth in the news media, television, radio, the major newspapers. Never in this country do you hear any of these issues proposed publicly by an elected member of the House or the Senate or in the White House or NBC or ABC or CBS, New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times. Never. And I think it's time for Americans to start looking at the facts about the Mideast situation, and only then, and based on the knowledge of the facts, will we ever have a chance to move forward and consummate a peace agreement that would give Israel what they need and what they deserve, permanent peace, recognized by their neighbors and all Arab countries and the rest of the world, and the Palestinians to have their human rights, their land and a chance to have their own state, side by side, living in peace with their Israeli neighbors.
After President Jimmy Carter spoke on Tuesday about his book, Palestine, Apartheid, Not Peace, he took questions from the audience. He was asked to outline what a balanced U.S. Middle East policy would look like. Again, his book is called Palestine Peace, Not Apartheid.
You know, the word balance is one that's almost unacceptable in our country. If you had a candidate for Congress running, either Democratic or Republican, and they announced to the general public, I'm going to take a balanced position between the Israelis and the Palestinians, they would never be elected. That's an impossibility in a country. But that doesn't preclude an incumbent administration from demonstrating with their own actions and words that they are concerned about Israeli peace. They are also concerned about peace and justice for the Palestinians. And that's what I did. It's what Richard Nixon did. It's what Ronald Reagan did after I left office. It's what George Bush Sr. did. It's what Bill Clinton did. But it's not being done now. There's a general feeling throughout the Arab world, throughout Europe, not even noticed in this country, that our present administration has not given any consideration, in my opinion, to the plight of the Palestinians. And you don't have to be anti-Israel to protect the rights of the Palestinians to have their own land and to live in peace and without being subjugated by an occupying power. So I think that that is a proper approach. If it is impossible during the next 2 years of President Bush's administration for him to take that, to use your word, balanced approach, then, as a fallback, it may be possible for the international quartet to take that role. And that would obviously be the United States playing a major role, but not the only role, and for it to involve the United Nations and Russia and the European Union. And I think they could say, okay, let us orchestrate a peace talks based on United Nations resolutions, based on the Camp David agreement that I've worked out, based on the Oslo agreement, and based on the will of a majority of Israeli citizens, and based on the roadmap that we ourselves have prescribed. By the way, every element of the roadmap has been adopted enthusiastically by the Palestinian side. None of the key elements in the roadmap have been adopted by the Israeli side. They have rejected all of them, and I have the actual action of the Israeli cabinet in the index, in the appendix to this book. So, but I think to summarize, the international group of leaders, the quartet, could make strong action, take strong action to implement the terms of the roadmap. Thank you all very much, and I will sign off the book.
Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter talking about his new book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to read the transcript or to see the speech. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back from break, our national broadcast exclusive with Brandon Mayfield and his wife, Mona, from Portland, Oregon. Stay with us. Thank you. Jimmy Smith and Wes Montgomery, The Road Song, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, as well as on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
The U.S. government has agreed to pay $2 million and issue a written apology to a Muslim attorney in Oregon who was jailed 2 years ago after the FBI mistakenly linked him to the Madrid train bombings. Brandon Mayfield was arrested and jailed for 2 weeks in May of 2004. At the time, the FBI claimed his fingerprints matched those found on a bag filled with detonators used in the Madrid bombing that killed 191 people. The FBI ignored warnings from Spanish authorities that the fingerprints were not Mayfield's. Prior to his arrest, the FBI used the Patriot Act to break into his home and office and to electronically monitor his conversations.
Brandon Mayfield is a former Army lieutenant. He sued the FBI alleging his civil rights had been violated and that he was arrested in part because he is Muslim. Brandon Mayfield and his wife Mona join us from Portland, Oregon, and we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
And we
Good
also
morning.
Thank you for coming into the TV studio in after the ice storm. But why don't we start with Brandon Mayfield? First, can you respond to the $2 million that your family is being awarded?
Obviously, we're happy with the settlement. It took us some time to get to this point, to get the government to agree to that settlement, and thanks in part to the wonderful work of my attorneys, Jerry Spence, Eldon Rosenthal, Michelle Eder. And as you're aware, it was a settlement for the money damages, and it allowed us to continue to focus on the most important part of the case, and that was the challenge of the constitutionality of the Patriot Act.
And for many of our listeners and viewers who are not familiar with your case, could you go through what happened initially, your initial contact with the FBI, and what were the circumstances around your arrest?
Well, initially, my family and I, Mona and I, were suspicious that we were being followed, monitored, surveilled, if you will. Even before the Madrid, Spain bombing, and that was back in March of 2004, and in April of that year, we were actually seeing telltale signs that somebody had been in our house, that had burglarized our home, such as doors that were left unbolted. That is where we would lock the bottom lock and not bolt it. We would come home and find the bolts locked. Blinds that were left closed, we would come back and find them partially opened. And even freshly vacuumed carpets, we would find footprints in a house that by custom we didn't wear shoes in the home. So that's our unofficial contact with the FBI. And that created a great deal of paranoia, fear, and suspicion even before I was actually arrested on May 6th of 2004.
Now, this was after the Madrid train bombings. So what happened after the bombings? Did this kind of what you believed was surveillance at the time intensify? Did you contact the authorities to see what was happening, who was possibly coming into your house?
Well, initially we thought maybe we were being actually burglarized, that there were burglars in our home. And in fact, that's kind of the way we characterize their break-in. It was certainly a sneak and peek to us, but for the FBI, local FBI's ineptitude, we wouldn't have known that they were in our home. But once they did, it created a great deal of fear and suspicion. And I think at one point I myself even made a point to try to contact the local authorities. I called the police or one of their dispatch units, and I didn't have an officer come to our home. But at some point, as the intensity increased, I had a good suspicion that it might be the local Federal Bureau of Investigation.
And in retrospect, what would have drawn the FBI to you, other than the fact that you are both Muslim? Were there any other activities that you were involved in that caught their attention?
It's hard for me to speculate, except that the FBI has denied that this was motivated. My arrest was motivated by any religious factors. Yet, if you look at the affidavit that was submitted in support of my arrest warrant, the search warrant, it mentioned things such as I was followed to the local mosque, a place of worship and prayer. I advertised in a Muslim Yellow Pages. My wife was Egyptian, that I represented a Muslim client. And so I think that would answer your question. But why would you mention these things other than there's some kind of insinuation that being Muslim somehow equates to being a terrorist?
Just looking at one of the pieces in the Oregonian saying court records showed less than 2 years earlier, before you were arrested, you represented Jeffrey Leon Battle in a custody dispute. Battle was a member of the Portland Seven, a group that was arrested in 2002 for plotting to fight with the Taliban against U.S. soldiers. One of the possible reasons that they were looking into you. Then talk about what happened after the bombings, when you were directly confronted, when you were arrested by the FBI.
Well, if you're talking to me, actually, Mona and I both were accosted, I at my office and her at our home, actually simultaneously at the same time. However, I think it was probably shortly after 10. Mona's my legal assistant. She helped me out at the office. On that particular day, on May 6, I had taken the kids to school. I was at the office. I was preparing for a wrongful death suit that I was handling. Had a lot of files. I think I called her. Did I call you that morning? Ask you when you were coming in?
Yeah.
I must have called her about 9 o'clock, 9:30, sometime in that time frame. I got an unexpected knock on the door, because I usually don't take clients unless it's by appointment, and Strangely enough, I saw a man and a woman standing there looking self-important, thinking that they were maybe trying to sell me something, and I thought I would just say hi, what is it that you need, I'm busy, and have them be on their way. But instead they forcefully pushed their way into my office, and at that point I told them, they identified themselves, said they were FBI agents, said they wanted to talk to me, and I kind of motioned for them to step out of my office, and I said, if you want to talk to me, you could put your questions in writing, and I may or may not get back to you. And at that point, then they continued to push their way into my office, and eventually handcuffed me, and identified that they were going to arrest me.
And Mona, what happened to you at home?
Actually, about between 10 and 10:15, I heard a knock at the door. And through the window, I have a window in my living room where I could see briefly what's outside. And I thought maybe it was the mailman or, I just could see blue suits or maybe Jehovah Witness or something of that nature. So I opened the door and I asked if I could help, may I help you? And they said that they had a few questions for me, and I believe I asked them who they were. They said they were the FBI. I said I'm not interested in talking to them. They said, this is different, and your husband's fingerprint was found on a bag in Madrid. I believe that's what they said. And at that point, it was surreal. I was in shock. I knew it wasn't true. The first thing that came to mind is either this is truly a mistake, or they're framing him. That's really what I thought at the time. And so they I had to let them in. They came in and they were in the house searching the home for about 6 hours while they called it containing the situation, put me in the dining room, at the dining room table. They proceeded to ask me questions. I don't really recall what they were asking me. And I really didn't have anything to say. There was nothing to say. I knew he hadn't been anywhere. I know he wasn't involved in anything. I just kept telling them that I really didn't have anything to say to them, and we hadn't done anything.
And
so they proceeded to search the home.
Did they take you in as well into their headquarters eventually and arrest you as well, or just search the home and take materials from your house?
No, they just searched the home and took materials from the house. At that point, I actually they were there, like I said, between 10 and a quarter after. I had to go pick up my children at school, and it was approximately 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and they were still there. I eventually had to, I asked them if I could leave and go pick up my children. They told me if I left, I could not come back if they were still there, because once I left, I could not come home.
Yeah. And Brandon Mayfield, there was I think earlier this year, a report by the FBI Inspector General, a very large report that was very critical of the FBI operation. But it suggested that they were also interested at one point in turning you into some kind of an FBI informant. Were any attempts done by them while you were in custody to do that? And could you talk about that period when you were, the 2 weeks that you were arrested?
Wow, that was a long and dark period in my past, and those are some pretty dark memories. The days I spent in lockdown, in shakedown, in shackles and chains. No, I wasn't approached to become an informant, if you will, I suppose. And I do know what you're talking about in the report. That was a rather lengthy report, a 300-page report, I believe it was by Glenn Fine. I think he's the one who's going to investigate the NSA warrantless wiretap program. But actually, not just to try to plug myself, but I've kind of taken account of what happened to me, even in preparing for trial. Now we haven't had to go to trial, but I actually have written a book, and I'm prepared to release it soon. And it chronicles all of that: the suspicion leading up to the arrest, the time that I spent in jail, in shackles and chains here at the Multnomah County Detention Center, and it was a pretty dark, horrific time. Even after our release, I mean, it's the hardest time that myself and my family have had to endure ever.
You said you were shackled and chained. Explain exactly the circumstances you were held in for the 2 weeks that you were imprisoned, Brandon Mayfield.
Okay, I was in the Multnomah County Detention Center, and it's fairly close to the federal courthouse. And I was first taken into custody of the federal marshals, then they turned me over to the jailers at the detention center. I was put down into a maximum security situation where you're in a 5x8 cell 24 hours a day. You can come out for approximately 1 hour a day. You're in there with a lot of other dangerous individuals, and I won't say that they're all dangerous, because some of them are accused of things that they didn't do, as I can appreciate at that point. Some of them are arrested. And by the way, they're arrested at that point on probable cause. I mean, that's the standard, that you only arrest if somebody is suspicious of a crime, and you have to have probable cause that a crime has been committed. You can't arrest or search somebody's place or arrest somebody without that standard. And that's been the standard for 200 years, since the inception of our Constitution and the amendment with our Bill of Rights. And that standard is slowly being eroded, and it has been since 1978 with the passage of the FISA Act, which allowed warrants to be issued if there was if the primary purpose was to gather foreign intelligence. And so little by little, there's been a whittling away at that standard bearer of and protection of our freedom and privacy. Go ahead.
Can I ask you when you were held for that two-week period? Were you ever brought before a judge at all? Or, in other words, what were the were you being held prior to being charged with something? Or were you being held as a material witness?
Yes, exactly. I was being held as a material witness. The FISA Act of 1978, it allowed the federal government to basically spy on us if the primary purpose was to gather foreign intelligence, if they could say the suspect was tied to foreign agents, if it was for a foreign intelligence gathering purpose. Patriot Act of 2001 amended that standard, and now they can spy on us if the significant purpose is for intelligence gathering. It's no longer primary. It's no longer foreign purpose. So virtually for anything they want, they don't have to have this standard of probable cause that a crime has been committed to get a search warrant for an arrest or for a search or an arrest. But FISA also undermines that probable cause, not FISA, the material witness statute of 1984. That's the statute under which I was arrested, and it's the statute that Ashcroft and company have used to further abuse our time-honored rights, because this administration is using the material witness not as a tool for securing somebody's testimony. They're using it to lock up individuals that they suspect of terror or committing a crime, and it's a misuse of the prosecutorial process.
In looking at the back on the case now, it's clear, and from the big report that came out, almost 300 pages, that Spanish officials were raising serious questions about the fingerprints from the beginning on the blue bag, but that the FBI was rather insistent. Finally, they link the fingerprints to an Algerian named Unan Dawood, who is among a group of militants, the Oregonian Rights, who blew themselves up in April as police were raiding their suburban Madrid apartment. The FBI agent in charge in Portland, Robert Jordan, told the Indianapolis Star, quote, "If a similar investigation was being conducted and we were provided a fingerprint identification, we would do exactly what we did in the case of Mr. Mayfield. Of course," he said, "we regret what happened to Mr. Mayfield, but again, we're proud of what we did here." Your response to that, Brandon Mayfield?
Okay. My response to that is, alhamdulillah, thank God that I was released. And God bless the Spanish police and their good police work. But for them fingering Unani Dayud, as you said, probably I would still be languishing in jail or labeled as an enemy combatant somewhere.
And the effects on your children?
Well, it's actually been difficult for them. It's really hard to tell in the long term how that's going to affect them, but I know that it will deeply, I mean, if it's going to affect an adult such as myself or my husband, I know it's going to affect the children for a lot longer. But, you know, they've been trying to deal with it, they're moving on, and we actually would like to move on. It's something that
we have 5
we'll
seconds.
We'll never forget.
I want to thank you both, Brandon and Mona Mayfield, for joining us. They've been awarded $2 million in apology for the U.S. government for arresting Brandon Mayfield. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.